Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
One thing that a producer, a friend of yours, said that really seemed telling was, look, people come to us for comfort. Like, they don't see us as the news. I thought that was incredible. And there is something fundamental about two different purposes. One would be, I'm going to edify and inform, and so I'm going to serve you some stuff that might be not that scintillating. It might be kind of boring. It's like broccoli as programming. And then there's this other direction that it's like, I'm entertainment. Like, I'm going to have a certain patter and rhythm and characters and something that you can cheer or boo.
Right. Yeah. And that was in one of our planning meetings. So that was a senior producer. And it's definitely something that, you know, stood out and something I remembered, because you're abdicating your role as a journalist. And it's confusing, because otherwise it kind of looks like a newscast. You know, you have an anchor sitting at a desk with, you know, the TV over his shoulder, and you're covering things that are in the news. That's what I think is really dangerous, when it looks like something that should be reliable, but it isn't really. Then that's to me where the problem comes in.
This week on Yang Speaks, we interview Ariana Picari, who until very recently was a producer at MSNBC. She resigned publicly, saying that the business model of cable news is distorting journalism in a way that is not good for the public. You can imagine why we wanted to talk to her. It's a fascinating conversation for those of you who wanted to understand the internal dynamics of what's happening in various news organizations. This is the episode for you. And Ariana has earned our respect and admiration for doing something that very, very few other people have done, and that's actually act on principle. So tune in this week. But before then, Zach and I are going to talk about a whole lot of stuff: the ongoing drama, the election, coronavirus, you name it.
And we're back. Andrew, real question, man. What's going on in the world? I want you, I think this is a good way to start the episode. Our listeners out there, there's no source of truth. There's news coming left and right saying the election's fake. It's not this. We've got coronavirus all over the place. We got a Georgia runoff. No one knows anything. For the average human, I feel for them, because there's just so much noise out there. So what is going on? Let's start with the election. Andrew, please make sense of this for me, for anybody listening. What's going on?
It is very painful, Zach. The Republicans have identified a strategy that's actually working for them politically, even though it's not going to change anything in the end, but it's changing a lot in the interim in a very painful way, where I saw something that said 50% of Republicans don't think this election was fair. And they've been leveling accusations that have been completely baseless and groundless and have no legal foundation. They just bring lawsuits, they get tossed out. You know, in a lot of these environments, there were Republicans who were definitely in the room counting votes, but also in some cases running the whole process. And they're looking up saying, like, why are you accusing me of fraud? I mean, there was a recount in Georgia, just confirmed it, that Georgia went for Joe. So this is a loser legally. It's a loser on Jan 20 when Joe becomes the new rightful occupant of the White House. But it turns out, and this is bad for all of us, it's a winner politically. It's a winner that there are all of these Republican voters who are very passionate about the fact that Trump somehow still should be the president, and that this election was not free and fair. And that's going to have negative effects for years. You know, it's like, if you can't trust something like a vote count that's been reported by every major media organization, you know, what's left to trust?
Here's what I thought I'd do. I'd try to put in some kind of here's what we know, here's what's happened, like factually. And I want to talk about someone who's controversial, Tucker Carlson, who, for context on Tucker, he says some things and does some things I really disagree with and do not like at all. But he was really fair to us on the trail. I think he was fair to a lot of candidates. And there are times he covers stuff that no one's touching, which I do respect. So this is what seems to have happened. Sidney Powell, who's one of Trump's attorneys, has done a whole bunch of press conferences with Rudy Giuliani right behind her, sweating his hair dye all over his face or whatever. She has claimed that, quote, communist money is being funneled, quote, communist money, end quote, is being funneled through Venezuela and Cuba to interfere with our elections, and is quoted saying that the voting software tracking votes broke because of the landslide victory and so many votes coming in for Donald Trump that it broke. And which I want to put in context, this is the president of the United States lawyer right now, has made an accusation of, in my opinion, I don't think this is an opinion, this is the greatest, that if it's true, would be the greatest crime in American history. Like literally a stolen election. Tucker Carlson said, literally, that's a major accusation. And he comes out there, Tucker, far right, says, I'll let you come on my show, but we have asked you a million times for evidence, and he's gotten nothing, received nothing.
Yeah, they have zero, and it's painful watching them fabricate various versions of reality. And it's even more painful seeing millions of Americans say, yeah. Right. The fact that Trump now is broken with Fox and now is saying, go to Newsmax and One America News Network. I mean, holy cow. I had to look up Newsmax. I had to be like, what, you know, like, do they have cable coverage? Like, is this a cable channel? Is this all digital? Is this like a...
It's dark, man. And Tucker is saying this is, if there's no proof, this is nonsense. And he's a stop. And that was my point, where if Tucker's doing it, guys, like, wake the hell up. This is just fake. This is literally the mind fuck part of my French.
It's working, too. That's the tough part.
It's working well.
The mind fuck is working.
Mitt Romney made a statement, finally, which in my opinion took too long, but he said, having failed to make even a plausible case of widespread fraud or conspiracy before any court of law, the president has now resorted to overt pressure on state and local officials to subvert the will of the people and overturn the election. And this is the statement part I love. It is difficult to imagine a worse, more undemocratic action by a sitting American president.
Hey, Zach, I just want to say that that Trump is still winning because we're still talking about Trump even though we lost. You know what I mean? Like we're falling in a trap just talking about like Mitt talking about Trump. I mean, like the concrete impact is devastating on two dimensions. Number one, public trust erodes further. The media landscape splinters further to even less responsible actors. I mean, that's hard to believe. And then number two, you have a really, really problematic transition where you have this government in waiting that is unfunded. It can't talk to anyone who's in government. There's a pretty long stretch between beginning of November and late January. You know, that's like a solid 2.5 months. And it's damaging where... you have like a real void or a vacuum or like a period when, frankly, no one's running the show. And we've kind of gotten accustomed to that as a country under the Trump administration. But like this is not the time for that with COVID spiking. So there's some very, very concrete negative effects of this dynamic for sure. I appreciate the folks that are trying to that even see it. Like Mitt Romney's like, oh my gosh, like this is getting so bad. Even I'm going to like, you know, like have to step in and try and express fact or reason. Fact and reason are losing in the United States. And that's the thing that I think most people are still struggling with, really. Like there's like mm-hmm. this fundamental notion that humans are reasonable, which I tend to believe we're reasonable a lot of the time. And media organizations fall into this trap in a very big way where it's like, well, I'm going to now like present you with fact and reason. I'm very reasonable. I'm a journalist or whatever. And more people are just saying like, I don't care what you say. I don't care what your evidence is. I want to believe this. I will believe this. You're an asshole. And we need to reckon with that in a different way. It's like the language of fact and reason will not work on that. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's clear that Trumpism has now transcended a particular unified set of facts. You know, now it's in like it's in like the land of human nature, and the land of human nature operates on reason somewhat. But it also operates on feeling and emotion and tribalism and anger and hate and humanity, really. And this is one thing that does make me empathetic in a particular way, is that there is something very dehumanizing to a lot of our institutional life today. You know what I mean? Like you have these folks who are kind of transformed into instruments of a bureaucracy or instruments of a major media organization. And then their progenitors of this narrative of reason say, hey, be reasonable. And then if people are put in circumstances that are actually very, very unreasonable, like let's say their, you know, town's only restaurant just closed because of COVID and like they're losing their job and like their family life's going to pieces. Then reason is not the right language, you know, and Trump has managed to tap into another language that is working very well on tens of millions of Americans. And the folks who are using the language of reason just keep looking up saying like, why, like, what is going on? Like at some point, the reasonable thing to do is to try and, peer into the realm of unreasonableness and say, okay, like what's going on here? You know, that's certainly where I am.
Well, the other reasonable thing to do is to ignore it or accept it as whatever. And what I was talking to my dad earlier is like, you know, we had a whole conversation on politics and he's like, this is so frustrating. You want to watch football? You want to go play golf? Like literally that's to distract yourself from
That would be a respite for us all, you know, and that's another thing that I dislike about what's happening here is we've had a very, very divisive and tumultuous 4 years politically. And unfortunately, it looks like it's just going to continue because Trump's going to bring the spotlight with him. And one thing we're going to talk to Ariana about in part is what the media organization's incentives are to cover or not cover Trump. So media organizations certainly built Trump up on the way up. And then when he's in the White House, in a way you can't fault them for just following him around all the time because he is the president. So the question is, what now? You know, like and if the media networks follow Trump around post-presidency, then we're really going to have like a very legitimate beef with them, shall we say. Like like that would be the clearest sign of like, hey, at this point, we just follow the man around because he rates. And and it does not matter if it's good or bad for the public. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad for the state of mind. But the tough truth is that Trump is just a much more interesting figure than most politicians, you know, I mean, he's just like more
by far,
like he evokes like a more visceral reaction, either positively or negatively. And right now we have news media that thrives on trying to evoke that kind of reaction.
Yeah. The news stopped caring about the well-being of the country and the people a long time ago. But it's,
I guess that's what we talked to Ariana about. I mean, that's what this episode's about in many ways.
Yeah. Meanwhile, like through all this, Americans are suffering and it is horrible. 12 million people going to lose unemployment benefits by the end of the year. And it's a good segue to tweet of the week where you said something that has 335,000 likes at this time right now, which is one probably your best ever potentially. You said,
oh, no, man, I've done better than that. I've done better than that shit. Yeah, like you look at the tape.
My bad. We'll look at the tape. It's up there, though. if we ask you to stay home, we should also send you money so you can do so. Which is a very good Andrew Yang, simple, like cut to the core. Thoughts on what's happening with our lack of relief bill, besides that it sucks, well, you can say that too, but thoughts on where your head's at or what you think needs to happen now.
I've gotten a couple of very big learnings over the last number of weeks and months. Learning number one is that Trumpism is still vital and powerful and rising because institutional mistrust is vital and powerful and rising. And despite Joe's victory, you know, we need to reckon with it still. The fact that this was not a blue wave. In a lot of parts of the country, it was a red wave. And I talked to folks who lost their elections. People like Max Rose, for example, where, like, you know, like I expected him to win, and I think, you know, most people expected him to win, and he didn't. And there are now seven members of Congress who lost their seats that are similarly surprised, I think. But the other big thing has been just the epic dysfunction out of D.C. Really, really shameful. And, you know, like, I at some point was like, look, Nancy should take this deal because it's going to be one of the only ways to get help to people before the end of the year. And I think it's pretty objectively reasonable. You know, it's like you'd rather get help sooner than later. I mean, people are freaking suffering. Like, restaurants and small businesses are closing right and left. And here we are, lame duck session. Like, is it going to happen? It's doubtful. And a lot of people are just like, well, it's freaking Mitch McConnell's fault. To which I largely agree. It's like Mitch McConnell should be approving legislation that it gets out the door. But I think you have to take some responsibility if you're the Democrats too, because you're looking at it saying, okay, like what is the offer on the table? Like, you know, what can I work with? What can I not work with? There comes a point when, doing something is better than doing nothing. And so that's another, like, I have been staggered by the level of, catastrophic dysfunction out of DC. It's been very, very heartbreaking, like saddening, like you name it. I mean, I think about it a lot. And this is a time when it'd be tough if we did everything right. You know, if we had a government that had a shit together and was like going around like A, B, C and the rest of it, and A would be, hey, we should send you all money. Like, other governments are doing it. Canada's doing it. But, you know, it's like the odds of you actually, one, trusting the public and the government and acting accordingly, and then two, not feeling like you have to go out and do that Uber shift or do something that's kind of discretionary to make ends meet, like, go way up if I sent you money. It does not make that much sense for me to think that you're going to comply and shut down if you're like a bar owner. If you're a bar owner and you're like trying to dig yourself out of like this deep, dark, like, well of red ink, and then I come and say, hey, shut down, you know, you'll be like, I, you know, it's like, and I don't send you money, then you'll be like, wait a minute, like, what are you talking about? You know, like, that, like, I need to employ people. Like, I've run a business, a small business, and like, you feel very, very deeply responsible for your staff. You know, and it's impossible to pay your staff unless you operate. And so, like, if you're told not to operate and you're looking at it being like, you know, and then there's like a human reaction. Again, if you send people money, they're much, much more likely to adhere to public health guidelines, to have like a sense of the future. Doing one without the other does not make that much sense to me. I think most other countries made the same conclusion. But our government is just not up to the challenge here. And it makes me sad how a lot of the commentary just revolves around, essentially, it is the other guy's fault. It's the other team's fault. Mm-hmm. And again, there's enough fault to go around, but, you know, like, at some point, someone has to govern. And it makes me very, very sad that that anyone who wanted to think the worst of DC is having their point of view confirmed every single day. You know, like, one of the things I almost tweeted that I have not, but maybe I should, is that if you give Washington an excuse not to work, it will take it. Because it turns out them not working really doesn't hurt them very much. You know, I mean, like they still have re-election rates of 90% plus. Like, they're still chilling. It's one reason why my backdrop is what it is. Like, I'm here in Georgia. Because we have to try and remove excuses for D.C. not to work. You know, like, if you actually give it, give Democrats a chance where it's like, well, it's not Mitch McConnell saying no, no, no to everything. It's like, well, then the odds of a relief bill getting passed would shoot up, I presume. And so, you know, I'm here trying to help make that happen.
You know, then there's this also argument. I agree with everything you said, so thank you. There's this other argument. It's like, well, We don't have to pay people. They don't need a relief bill if you just opened up the economy, right? Like, start shutting things down. Just let's navigate this. Only a small percentage of people getting COVID. And what I think is so wrong is that even if you did open up the economy, like, no, like, nothing held back. You, like, talk to restaurant owners. They're not at 100% capacity. Talk to restaurant owners in the South where it's all open. They're like,
demand is very, very low. Yeah. You know,
and that's because,
I mean,
it's a, like, virus.
It's like Disney World reopened, and they, like, did they have, like, you know, throngs of people, like, flocking to go there? No. So because guess what? Like, there are a certain number of people that are just going to look up and say, is COVID still out there? Yes. Like, hey, maybe I'll stay home.
No.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, I brought my family here to Georgia, the airport was pretty empty, you know? So on the one hand, you're like, well, good for me, in the sense that, you know, like, your risk level feels lower. But then you're like, the level of ambient economic activity is very low. And that's not because of government-enforced shutdowns. That's because of millions of Americans just making an individual determination that trip to Disney World's not worth it right now.
Right. And it's one of the reasons, like, you and I were pretty bummed. Like, our plan was just bring a whole bunch of people to Georgia and knock on doors and do all these things. And look, not only is COVID still real, but it's growing. And we can't do that. We can't bring, sadly, like, thousands of Yang, you know, Yang Speaks listeners to come volunteer in Georgia, because it's horrible. That's how you spread the virus. And it breaks my heart. And we had a lot of ambitious plans. But, like, sadly, we have to pump the brakes a bit, you know, and it makes sense.
No, I'm genuinely torn on this, Zach, because I saw that maybe 1,000 Republican operatives are descending on the state.
Really?
Yeah. And, $32 million in funding on that side. And so you want to be smart. I genuinely think that you could campaign in a way that does not truly elevate the COVID risk. You know, mm-hmm. like, if you're walking around outside, you have a mask on, and you interact with folks, like, I don't think the risk is really being increased by your presence. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you can imagine someone who lived in, like, you know, let's go to North Carolina, they had to drive X hours to come through here, and then they do some campaigning in a way that's responsible. Like, I truly don't think that actually elevates the risk. At least, you know, it doesn't elevate the risk in a way that, to me, would foreclose the activity. And there are folks that are like-minded to me, so I should have some fun people spending time on the ground here in Georgia. It should be fun, both from inside and outside the state. I mean, we've got a lot of work to do inside the state. I've got events with, like, a high school Democrats group, a college Democrats group, Asian American community, the WNBA, Martin Luther King III, like, you know, like, all sorts of fun stuff coming.
There's good work to be done.
So I'm of two minds about it, genuinely. It's like, I think you'd want to temper any activities you have here so that they're responsible and safe. You don't want to, you know, just, like, have a mosh pit or something. But if you come and, like, you're wearing a mask and you're, you know, trying to register voters, that's happening all the time right now. It'd be optimal, obviously, if, like, people got themselves tested and did things where they're like, okay, like, I'm sure I'm not spreading anything. But I think that this is an all hands on deck situation, and I think that at least one side is going to be treating it that way.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought, if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial.
and 10 to 15 year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product. And if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
So we hit, as of yesterday, which is, yesterday was November 19th when we're recording this, 187,000 new cases, which is essentially a record. If you look at the graph of cases, it's a tidal wave. It's an exponential increase. Thoughts on, you've got Thanksgiving. Normally, this upcoming Wednesday is the busiest travel day of the year. Suggestions for people traveling for Thanksgiving. I think some of these some of the curfews are, you know, things like that are getting ridiculous. But thoughts on how people handle their travel and holiday season this year?
I can speak for myself. I mean, our plan was to have family members over, and most of them were within like a driving distance. Most of them are very safe, and the rest of it. And so we didn't have a problem with that. That would have been a fine plan. Here in Georgia, some people invited us over for like a socially distanced dinner. It's very nice of them. And it would, again, just be a drive. So as long as you're not interacting heavily with folks in an indoor environment on the way there, and you're comfortable with the people that you're going to be seeing, and maybe even socially distanced throughout, like I think that's a fine way to go.
Okay. Yeah, we're doing the same thing where we have like a small family gathering, but everybody's been quarantined and things like that. I do encourage people to be safe. COVID is serious. And now,
again, just don't go to that Thanksgiving rave, you know, don't go to like that, that indoor rave.
Be careful.
That's all. Yeah. I think like getting together with family and extended family, who you're, in contact with somewhat periodically, like as on, like particularly if they're not high risk. Like I wouldn't recommend visiting your elderly parents necessarily, but you know, like that's not a good idea at any point during this during this virus.
So the last thing I think I want to ask you, Andrew, is that like it kind of gets brushed on the rug with all the election nonsense, but we have a vaccine now. We haven't been able to talk about it. We've two, it looks like two vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer, both seem to have 95% effective COVID vaccines, which to me is like, I've always been a capitalist, like pro-capitalism, in my opinion. Like America is like hyper-focused.
Thank you,
on
science. Yeah,
that.
We came up with like science gear just for the occasion. Science cap, science mask. I wish I had one, I could put it on right now. But go science, and this one, thank you, Moderna and Pfizer.
Yeah.
I'll never say anything mean about you again, pharma. I'm
ever.
Kidding.
Well,
you guys, I'm kidding. They're problems.
do you, like... you've said this before on other things. I think we should make the politicians try it on their own families before it goes out, which I know is like kind of weird. Like politicians get it first, but there's a lot of mistrust in the system right now in our world. Like thoughts on how you would roll this out effectively?
I think having trusted public figures make use of the vaccine is a good idea. You know, like if the science checks out, I would do it. The thought process is like, you know, look, everyone's going to get this thing eventually anyway, might as well get this show on the road and do it in a way that augments adoption. There was an idea out of Freakonomics, our friends at Freakonomics, Stephen Dubner, which I think was a really good one, is we should just have a freaking lottery where like every day someone who gets the vaccine is going to get $100,000 and just like publicize that winner. Just like pay, and like, you know, I mean, it would be a trivial cost to increase adoption. Because if you gave $100,000 a day, like what does that amount to? Like $36 million over the year. That's like a penny compared to the cost of getting adoption up,
not vaccinating
and reviving it. So maybe $100,000 is too conservative. Maybe we should go with like $1 million a day. You know, like $365 million would still be worth it. So
I love that idea.
I think that's a, and then just publicize it. It's like the vaccine. you know, winner of the day is like this person, and being like, I never thought I'd win, you know, just freaking publish that thing every single day. That's the kind of thing we should do to increase adoption. That would actually work better than me getting it.
Yeah, that's true, because people don't trust politicians anyway. That'd be fun. Yeah, anybody, if you get your vaccine,
you could do a million in like giving out in increments. It could be like you get $500, you get $20,000, like just freaking go bananas. Don't you guys love how Andrew Yang's answers to a lot of things revolves around giving people money?
Cash.
Like, you know, does that not work on a whole host of problems?
I'm into it, man. I'm actually into actually just paying people directly to take the vaccine, too.
Also a great idea. Wait. Let's do some math on this. Hang on. Let's say you need 330 million people vaccinated, like $10, like $3.3 billion. Again, trivial in the context of trying to resuscitate a $22 trillion economy. You get a vaccine, we'll give you $10 and a lollipop. You know, you had a kid a kid with you.
I want to make sure we quickly talk about Humanity Forward too, on a lot of the stuff we're doing on cash relief, because we've looked at this left, right, and sideways, you know, every direction, and the only way we get anything done in Congress is by actually building that network in Congress and talking to them, our elected officials, and convincing them that cash relief is the only way forward to get us out of this pandemic. And it's not a hard argument, but it takes time and money.
Oh, I do this every day. You know this, Zach. I talk to, on average, at least one, maybe closer to two or three members of Congress on any given day, saying, hey, you know what would be great? Cash relief. And a lot of them are into it. So we have to just keep pushing because the people know it's right. A lot of legislators, you get them one-on-one, they know it's right too. So we just need to make it safe for them all to move forward and act. So we're trying to build a caucus on Capitol Hill, and we could really use some resources to do so. It's like the people's lobbyist, where I had a video where it's like, we're going to raise money for this effort and then pelt members on the head with the money. But the truth is that politicians respond to financial resources because they know that they're going to be up for re-election in 2 years or whatnot. And if someone gets behind them, let's say the Yang Gang, you know, let's say like a group that's like 1 to 2 million strong, depending upon like how you're counting it, then members of Congress look up and say, ooh, like this could actually make my race easier. And it's also the right thing to do. And then if the organization has money behind it, then they're like, ooh, like, you know, this group might actually put resources into my race. Like when I run for re-election, if I am pro cash relief, like they could actually help defend me. That's the kind of thing that tips legislators over the finish line. So we just need to raise enough money where they can see that we have a professional lobbying org with a bankroll that can actually help get them reelected. I mean, that's like the crass reality of it all. So we are raising money for this effort. Again, the people's lobbyist. And we are punching way above our weight class already because everyone regards the Yang Gang as this awesome, cool, vital new force in politics.
Yeah, they're like me. They're a little terrified of the Yang Gang too if they mess up. Love you guys.
So we need to take advantage of this in the biggest way. So you've probably seen we have a national advocacy campaign that we're raising money for. That is essentially this lobbying campaign. And it's a phenomenal investment in the sense that we can increase the odds of cash relief getting out there. So if you give $10, you know, like we might be able to help increase the chances of you getting a lot more out of Congress than might otherwise be the case.
Yep. It's going to research, it's going to experts on the Hill, it's going to organizing, and it's going to advertising. It's like the big four. It's pretty standard, but we'll do it in very Andrew Yang style where it's out of the box, effective, high ROI, the same way a good builder should.
Let's do it. Let's go fight it out on the Capitol Hill. And I'm excited about it because I've been having these conversations with members, and a lot of them are receptive and responsive. So if we have the resources
on both sides,
both sides.
And we're not yet allowed to talk about who's committed, but it's
who?
No, we can't tell. But if you're interested in donating, it's movehumanityforward.com. you click the donate button. It's all going to Cash Relief right now. Advocacy, lobbying, efforts to get this done.
People already probably know that, like, we've given almost $10 million directly to families. So, you know, we believe. But like, I think that this is another very effective way to try and unlock cash for people. You know, the needs are so great. Like, I see this as like, we'll spend $1 million to maybe unlock tens of billions. You know what I mean? It's like a very high leverage move. It's there too. I mean, the stock market's pricing in that there's going to be a stimulus bill of $1 trillion. So the question is, eventually, when God willing, Congress does something. So the question is, what's the composition of the trillion? You know what I mean? Like right now, you know, that trillion's probably going to get tilted very much towards institutions. If you tilt it more towards people, that's a potential value of hundreds of billions of dollars for people, families, communities.
Amen.
And you know, that's what I'm chasing.
One of my favorite quotes, like, the only thing necessary for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. And Andrew and I, you and I, we've been to the top of the political mountain, if you will. We've met the leaders, we've met the help, we've met the people that are supposed to be saving us. And I promise you, the cavalry's not coming. This is it. Like, this is the coalition of the good people trying to do something. And this is us. And it's terrifying, but this is how anything gets done. And so we our ask is, you know, help us do good. This is what we're doing. Help us be the good people. And let us be the cavalry, because it's not coming. It's just us. So, MovieMania4.com. We're doing some cash relief. We're going to be doing a while. We'll keep you updated on the show. And with that, let's go to Ariana Picari and talk about all the problems in our media. And you can go on for days on this, Andrew. But tune in, guys. It's good.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
It is my pleasure to welcome to Yang Speaks the public editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and former MSNBC producer, Ariana Picari. Ariana, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. I'm a huge admirer, as I know many people are, because you did something that dozens of people imagine doing. Millions of people are wondering why more of it doesn't go on. But you actually resigned from an MSNBC producer role because you were concerned about the nature of broadcast journalism in terms of fulfilling its function and edifying the public. And I want to start all this out by saying that you identify issues that are germane to any broadcast media news outlet, that this isn't like a, you know, some kind of MSNBC is like singular. And despite the fact that I'm on air on CNN, like, I 100% agree with you that these issues are endemic to essentially the medium, and it's not just an MSNBC thing. So many Americans right now are concerned that we are more polarized than ever. And I think a huge part of that in people's minds is that the media is not helping. The media is not really bringing us together around a common set of facts, but instead is kind of separating us into camps.
For sure. And I, that was one of my big concerns when I was at MSNBC. I definitely saw, and, the polarization, I was living it in real time, and I could see how it affected my family at home in Virginia, right away. And it's weird. I felt like the polarization was almost having, it was having kind of a counter productive effect in some ways for MSNBC. But yeah, I call it, you know, I some ways call it the gerrymandering of the media, you know, and everyone on the left kind of keeps getting pushed further and further to the left, and on the right, they keep getting pushed further and further to the right. And really it's driven largely, not entirely, not wholly, but largely by, you know, the financial incentives that are required. You know, they gin up their audiences, and so, you know, it's being done for profit, and by and a very few people are actually benefiting. So yeah, my concerns are definitely, you know, for the democracy at large, and it plays out in many ways.
So you started out in a different environment in public radio. So how was that experience for you? I guess that was relatively early in your career.
Yeah, I started, right after college, I had a crisis of identity and I didn't know what I was going to do. So I started all first and working as a financial advisor for Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. And it was actually kind of during that miserable commute around the DC Beltway, I discovered public radio. And over a number of years, I kind of set my sights on public radio because I realized that's really what I wanted to be doing. I just love the craft of it. And I loved the way that they told stories. I had never had a desire to go into TV. And I also didn't really do internships through college because I was, you know, working full time and just a little bit lost in general. So it wasn't until a while after college I discovered NPR and set my sights. And I started at NPR in 2002 and loved every day from the, you know, first minute I was there.
So you were attracted to NPR. And I have to say, when I was out there campaigning around the country, NPR was like its own oasis of news. Like there were folks that listened to it. The local NPR stations seemed very free. They were very pure. You'd go in and they had listeners who really wanted a particular version of both the news and the listening experience. You were attracted to that. And it sounds like you were there from 2002 to 2013, more or less. I mean, you were doing some other stuff, but it was all public radio directed. Is that right? Mm-hmm. It's like 11 years or so?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I just this morning I was listening. I listen to KQED frequently, which is a San Francisco station. And, you know, it's such a, you know, pleasure because the local public affairs program forum, they covered the local drug overdose epidemic and how it's gotten worse through the pandemic. And then they moved on to the new COVID vaccines for another 30 minutes. And it's this long, in-depth conversation and things that I didn't even know I needed to know. But yeah, I mean, it's just so much more and so such better information that you can get.
Yeah. And NPR is supported through public funding. Though NPR now has so many listeners and sponsors and advertisers that it's largely self-sustaining, and a lot of people have also donated to it. So it's like a combination. And then you wound up at MSNBC, which it seemed like your experience was a bit different. How was the experience?
Starting at cable, I kind of came into it with the attitude. I mean, we knew that everything was kind of, you know, we knew that ratings, I knew that ratings played a part in our daily lives. I didn't understand the extent of it. And I thought coming in, I could bring my skills that I had in public radio. And part of that is really trying to find new and interesting and compelling stories and angles and voices. And they would want to, you know, they would welcome that because in my mind, I felt like one of my big criticisms of cable news coming into it was the repetition. It was just, I just felt like it was, you know, you're watching the same five or six stories kind of all day throughout the day. So I thought that that was an opportunity for me to come in and, you know, make things better, right? So I struggled with that for a few years. I tried different types of stories and kind of I strengthened my pitches and realized, okay, they might not listen to me the first time, but I'll keep coming back and, you know, trying to sell this other idea or strengthen my argument. Maybe they don't, you know, maybe it's not intuitive why something is a good idea. And over time, I got a little bit frustrated, but then started to get at the same time a little bit of seniority. So I was more involved in the planning meetings, you know, with the senior producer and the executive producer, and or the senior producers. There's usually more than one. And at that point, I realized the extent that the ratings really drove all of the decisions. And it's down to, you know, it's the first thing out of their mouths as soon as you throw out an idea. And they don't necessarily talk that way in the wider editorial meetings with a full staff. It really was in the smaller planning meetings. You know, it's the first thing out of their mouths, like how things rated the night before, how they thought something did. And those ratings are broken down by quarter hour. So they have a pretty good understanding of what did well and what didn't do well. And so they will track the topics, of course, and they'll track the guests, you know, if the guest does well or if a guest rates well or not. They really rely on that for almost every decision. So it wasn't until the last few years when the reality became, you know, pretty stark to me. And then, you know, I wasn't going to be able to fight that fight. You know, there wasn't, you know, these people are just doing their jobs and it's all out of their hands. It's out of Lawrence's hands. It's out of Phil Griffin's hands. It's at a higher, way higher pay level where the problems are.
Yeah. One of the things you said was that, look, these are good people, you know, trying to do good work, but they're put in a position where their job does not necessarily produce the kind of journalism you'd want it to, which is something I completely get and empathize with, is that if you put people in a position where their incentives are all steering them one direction, you kind of expect them to end up listening to those incentives. You know, it's like, and if you don't listen to those incentives, and let's say your ratings underperform consistently, then someone's going to make a change. And so, like, that's the race you're always running. Like, were there other people that ever expressed any misgiving? Maybe someone else from like a similar background as you?
Yes. Those conversations didn't happen very often, but over the last year or two when I was there, there were times when I would have conversations in private with other producers. And certainly they, you know, with a couple of people, they said, I think we're making things worse. You know, some seem to think that, yeah, what we're doing here is probably benefiting Trump and would help him get elected again. The person who said we are a cancer, that's one of those conversations. It was somebody in the building and has been in the business a long time. So, but it wasn't something that people talked about in the open. You know, it wasn't until I went in and sat down, like kind of one-on-one with them. Otherwise, the notion that ratings drive everything, it's really built into the process. And it's of course, you know, that's just what you do. And, you know, most of those people came up through the commercial TV system somehow. And I obviously have a public radio background, and none of the editorial decisions I ever made before were based on how it would rate or how big of an audience we thought we would have. I mean, we always wanted a big audience. You know, you hope that, you know, what you're doing is compelling enough to hold people's attention. But that's not what determines those decisions. And so for me, you know, it was like it really raked against my nerves every time I heard them say something like, you know, that's not going to rate. And when it's something that I knew would be a good topic, some of the decisions were made out of ideological reasons. but it also kind of drives the division that we're seeing and the polarization in this in the country. So they might be pumping up, you know, ideas that are exciting to some people, but then there was never, you know, they don't get excited about the, you know, someone with a more nuanced or moderate take on things. And so that just kind of keeps driving everybody apart. And there's, you know, there's no sense that, okay, there is some benefit to compromise every now and then. I know that that's not a popular idea right now because we've gotten so far away from that. But, you know, in my sense is that when you stand back and look at the totality of, you know, all the different ways that the financial incentives affect the content, it's just driving us down the wrong path. And it's only getting worse the way that I see it.
You drew a couple of examples in your resignation letter, which I recommend that everyone find and read, because I just thought it was so brave and incisive and true. So thank you for it. And I'm a huge admirer of yours. You did something out of principle that the vast, vast majority of people don't ever do. And if enough people did what you did, we might actually have a chance. And I don't mean just in media, though the media is a significant part of this, but you know, in many different environments where your financial incentives are to just pretend it's okay, and a lot of us can sense that it's not okay. So two of the things that you pointed out as programming choices, one was that anything with Donald Trump or a response to Donald Trump rated better, and so just every cable news outlet covered everything Trump did during his 2016 run. And then that became true, obviously, when he was president. And then the inverse of that was that if there was something kind of educational or scientific or deeper, then it would be less appealing or wouldn't rate as well. And so you wound up with like a bias towards Trump all the time and less about, for example, what a public health official or scientist was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And initially, when the pandemic started, they are professional journalists and they kicked into gear just like they should. And they were trying to get the information they could from scientists and doctors and frontline workers, and developed a special. Dr. Zeke Emanuel was, you know, on once a week to cover, you know, focus on issues related to COVID. And after a number of weeks, they discovered that that wasn't rating well. So then it got kind of, you know, started on Monday, Tuesday, and then they pushed it to a Friday because that's a day that they don't care as much about ratings, because that's for our own program, for MSNBC's or Last Word's own programming needs, that it wasn't as important. And then it slowly just kind of fizzled out and died. And it was because it wasn't rating well. And then you could see the coverage when they would do a COVID segment. It really was about just the politics. And they would have on science reporters or correspondents, but they were, you know, pushing them, trying to get them to talk more about the politics than the actual science. And it was through a time when there were a lot, you know, there's still lots of information coming out all the time about the virus and vaccines and what we know and what we don't know. And that all of that was, you know, they would try to get to it if they could, or it just wasn't kind of the top line. It was something that was thrown in maybe as a, you know, an afterthought. That all of that information really got pushed to the wayside, and they focused much more on the politics. And it was, you know, the Trump attacking the blue state governors, or, you know, what dumb thing Trump said or didn't say or didn't do. It really focused on that. And I understand there's a time and a place for that, but it was just dominated everything.
That drove me crazy on the trail too, where it was always like Trump's stupid or inflammatory comment of the day. And then even like I'd be running for president in Iowa, New Hampshire, and they'd be like, Trump said this. What do you think of that? And I'm just like, are you kidding
right.
me?
Yeah. really? Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, that same idea was pervasive throughout the, you know, and it was the last election cycle as well, the Democratic primary process. You know, if there was a personality dispute, that got way more attention than any interesting policy conversation. And I think there were lots of interesting policy conversations we could have had, you know, the ideas that you had being the start of it. But then, you know, when it came down to the general and it was Biden versus Trump, and, you know, almost every single I know that they tried to focus on Biden when they could, but it always turned into a segment about Trump. You know, they don't want to talk about anything that is negative towards Democrats because that was bad for the MSNBC audience. And the same thing, you know, applied to the Democratic primaries as well. You don't, there just wasn't a full discussion that ultimately benefits everyone. So
I think I might have been part of that or not part of that.
Yeah, I know. This is not exactly an unbiased audience I'm talking to right now. But,
yeah, no. I mean, again, like this to me is more of like a systemic
broadcast problem. No, it for sure problem. Is. And I saw it happen. I watched it in 2016. And so, that you know, when everybody was, I'm sorry, when everyone was shocked that Hillary didn't do better than she did, I was frustrated because I was like, no, there were polling numbers out that showed, you know, enthusiasm for her, you know, that were concerning. And, you know, that MSNBC wasn't covering that. So that liberal audience didn't necessarily.
Well, that's rough, you know, like that there were actually some numbers that cut the other way that weren't covered. I mean, that's actually new to me, relatively speaking. Maybe everyone knows that already.
I was angry almost every day in those meetings. I mean, it was not pleasant because I was at a point where I mean, I never really bite my tongue anyway, but I just could not believe that they were making decisions about, you know, economic segments and, oh, that's not going to, you know, the day that I gave my resignation, they canceled an economic segment because, quote, it wasn't going to rate. And they filled it with some other, like, you know, not a serious segment. And I, you know, between the pandemic and I frankly had issues with how they were covering the George Floyd stuff, the protests. Again, you know, the way that they covered the protests, they wanted conflict. And they put the correspondents on the ground in a way that they even if nothing was happening, they wanted it to seem like something was happening. And if there was a car that was on fire, they're going to play that video over and over again. Meanwhile, 95% of the protests were peaceful. But I've been in the control room going back to 2015 and the Black Lives Matter protests then. People, they would monitor all of those protests. They'd have cameras and choppers, you know, there monitoring the protests. And unless it turned violent, they would not, quote, take it live. You know, they wouldn't show that peaceful protest because nothing was happening, according to them. You know, it was boring and it wouldn't make good TV. So that that is a type of thing that kind of got to me through the George Floyd coverage. There were other elements. There were points about the election and election security. Those stories kept getting sidelined. They were not covering them. They'd, you know, I was trying to get them to cover the issues. You know, how are you going to have a safe election, you know, with COVID? And, you know, there were lots of groups working on it. It was really, really, really difficult to get them to cover that. There were opportunities when Trump went to Tulsa. There were opportunities to talk about some of the kind of painful history in this country. It would have been very easy to discuss the history in Tulsa and the Tulsa riots or Juneteenth and what is all behind, you know, what is behind that and why it's so meaningful to the African-American community. And you can trace the anger from those events to George Floyd. It would have been, it wouldn't have taken very long at all, but there was a history there that I didn't know. And I know a lot of smart people and journalists didn't know. And it was a perfect opportunity to share that. And it helps the nation understand, you know, what is happening other than just, you know, people are angry and looting the local Walmarts.
One thing that a producer, a friend of yours, said that really seemed telling was, look, people come to us for comfort. Like, they don't see us as the news. I thought that was incredible. And there is something fundamental about two different purposes. One would be, I'm going to edify and inform, and so I'm going to serve you some stuff that might be not that scintillating. It might be kind of boring. It's like broccoli as programming. And then there's this other direction that it's like, I'm entertainment. Like, I'm going to have a certain patter and rhythm and characters and something that you can cheer or boo.
Right. Yeah. And that was in one of our planning meetings. So that was a senior producer. And it's definitely something that, you know, stood out and something I remembered, because you're abdicating your role as a journalist. And it's confusing, because otherwise it kind of looks like a newscast. You know, you have an anchor sitting at a desk with, you know, the TV over his shoulder, and you're covering things that are in the news. And so the audience, you know, I realize that, you know, there's an awareness that MSNBC is more opinionated than the straight, you know, 6 p.m. newscast. But at the same time, they play it both ways. So that's what I think is really dangerous, when it looks like something that should be reliable, but it isn't really. Then that's to me where the problem comes in.
I'm pretty sure news is in the name somewhere. You know, like, there's somewhere in there, like, there's the word news. So you have these concerns that are building up over a period of time. And then you actually had to bite the bullet and say, wait a minute, am I going to keep doing this, or am I going to leave? And when you did decide to leave, again, I thought it was so courageous, because you weren't sure what the next step was. It wasn't one of these situations where you were like, oh, I'm going to bide my time and then get some kind of sweet job offer and this other thing, and then I'll, you know, write my letter. So what was it that actually pushed you to action? Because again, I'm sure that there are dozens or hundreds of people in media who've at least reflected for a moment on the concerns you're describing, but they did not do what you did.
Well, I first want to say, I don't blame most of the people in the industry for not just picking up and quitting their jobs, because the industry is in a crisis. I mean, the last several years, they've done relatively well, but
I don't blame anyone either, FYI. Yeah.
Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Like, if you want to stay in some element of the news business, then there really aren't a lot of other places to go. And if you have a family and a mortgage, you know, dependents, it's a really hard choice to make. So I don't point fingers at them. But I got to a point where I had been contemplating leaving for a couple of years. I wasn't, you know, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. I had not pursued other jobs aggressively, because I knew I was probably going to want to work on this issue some way, somehow, and probably come out. When I posted my resignation letter, I thought I was just kind of putting that down as like a marker in the sand to say, this is, you know, where I draw the line and I'm moving on. And I thought that, you know, maybe a handful of people would respond to it at the time. I thought it was going to get lost to the internet, but I was going to use that just as like, you know, moving forward, you know, I quit the industry and this is why. I didn't expect the reaction that I did, but it really was kind of all together. I just couldn't, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and not a great time economically to quit one's job, you know, because it was a good job and with good benefits, and you know, now I don't have any of that. But I have not regretted it for one second. I don't have that angry feeling in me every day when I wake up. So,
wow. That's profound. So you post this resignation letter, you think, well, a few industry types will see it, but it'll just get lost the internet. And you said that you weren't expecting the reaction
that it got. What was that reaction? I mean, I certainly know that I saw it and said, like, wow, this person's awesome. I need to reach out. But like what, but I don't know what you experienced at that point. So yeah, like what happened next?
Well, it was interesting. You know, one of the first outlets that picked it up was Fox News, and they helped prove my point for me by saying, you know, MSNBC producer writes scathing letter about the divisive nature of her network, you know, and without, they took out all of the context, which is what they do, you know, and it's something that kind of drives up their audience and for clicks, you know, to get attention.
Each side loves it when they can point out that the other side is somehow,
absolutely. Yeah.
Bad or wrong.
Yeah. So I got a lot of response. I got thousands of notes, and you know, whether it was through my personal website, which until then had, you know, like you know, maybe two visitors. The piece itself has been read over 300,000 times on the actual website, but then there was lots of coverage elsewhere, and people wrote to me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and through my website. I have thousands of notes from people across the spectrum. You know, certainly a lot of people on the right who read the Fox piece, you know, they were, you know, cheering me on. I think they think I might be something different, but people on the left also, and former producers in the industry, and academics, and grandparents,
and presidential candidates.
Yes, yes, they were like, you know, but there was this sense that, like, thank you, like, we know that something is wrong, and a lot of people, they're like, you know, we don't know why it's gotten so as bad as it is, and this helps explain that. And, you know, some people will say, you know, what, are you naive, like, to think that ratings don't drive, you know, the news business or corporate media or whatever. And my reaction to that is, what, are you naive to think it's not doing damage to our lives every day? You know, I just got, like, it was really heartwarming. Across the spectrum, I got really thoughtful, kind notes thanking me for what I did.
I thank you. Everyone should be thanking you, Ariana, because we all can sense that something is going wrong. And you were one of the only brave souls who came out from within one of these organizations and said, yeah, you're not imagining it. It actually is going wrong. And it's not good for any of us, the country, the democracy, our states of mind.
I thank my mom for giving me a place to live in the meantime, so I don't crank through my savings too much. But I was in a position where I felt like it was it wasn't an easy decision, but it was a relatively easy decision given the state of things. So.
So you get this outpouring of support, and now you turn your attention to how can we solve these problems. And it was that producer colleague of yours who said, these forces are a cancer, but if you can cure the cancer, then you can heal the world. So I'm sure that now you've been doing some deep digging and thinking as to how we can fix this. You're now the public editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. I think you're reviewing CNN. Is that right? What does that job consist of anyway? First, let's go there.
Well, it's, you know, once every couple of weeks, weighing in on something that I think that, you know, something that I've observed. And they wanted me to use my experience as a producer. And so it's impossible for me not to watch it without that eye. So I can't help it. And I hope I don't have tunnel vision, but I see so many of the decisions that are driven by ratings, and so that's, you know, that I coming into it, I know the challenges of the job, and so I've wanted to give them credit as well where I could, because I just know it is an incredibly difficult job, and the people are very smart, and they want to do the right thing, and you know, most of what they're doing is, you know, news of some sort. But I also know, just I know the systemic issues as I think well as
anyone would. Probably anyone. And so I have tried to
come at it from that angle with, you know, understanding and compassion, but like dinging the overall structure of the industry.
So how do we fix the structure? And I'm just going to throw out a few big ideas just because, you know, I think these are the kinds of things you might need. So one reason why NPR seems so free and glorious is because its commercial incentives are less dominant, where, you know, it's getting money from philanthropy or the feds or to some extent sponsors. And you have the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CPB, which also funds PBS, delightful PBS, you know, or like you kind of sense the difference immediately when you hit one of these public channels, because it's kind of slower, softer, more wholesome, like less well lit, the sets are worse. One thing I sense about them too is like the rhythm is different. And you talk about like the cable news rhythm. There's like a drum beat of graphics and the rundown. You know, it feels a little bit like a sports highlight show. And then when you watch something on PBS or NPR, sometimes the conversations are longer, more drawn out. They're quote unquote like more boring, I guess, or they're presented in a way that's less flashy, for sure. So number one would be trying to lift the ratings pressure in some way. I think that, you know, you could start introducing things that might help. One thing I imagined, which no one would go for, but I imagine a world where essentially like an hour of advertising blocks is like bought by public funding. And then you can actually just do like an hour block of stuff ad free. And you could just have a sit down conversation with an expert and just like do that. And, you know, and like kind of change the rhythm of it in a way that I think would be conducive to something informative. A third one I'm going to throw out there, which I don't know how you would interpret this, is to try and revive the fairness doctrine from 1985, which was that if you're broadcasting something issue related, then you have to cover both sides of the issue. And that was in place before Fox and MSNBC came into being in, I think, the mid-90s. So that's another possibility. I don't know if those ideas are things that you've already weighed, and some of them you like, some of them you don't like.
Let's see here. Formatting, you know, they basically don't want to give any, you know, a person more than like 2 minutes of talk time per segment. And obviously in public radio and PBS, they will give more time. And I think that people will stick with you if you're having a deep, meaningful conversation, and they're actually learning something. Because I think humans are inherently, instinctually curious animals, and if they're learning something new that they didn't know already, then you know they'll keep watching. But that's another discussion. In terms of what can be done about the industry, I have not thought about the block advertising. That's an interesting idea. I think there are things that can and should be done on both sides. I would love to see public media enhanced and improved somehow. And, you know, I find myself, I mean, I agree with you. I think NPR is, for me, it's probably the most reliable and consistent in terms of getting news and information. PBS is great, but you get the news hour for 1 hour a day. And I would love to see a public affairs channel on the public side, dedicated to public affairs. And so that might mean multiple channels for PBS, which would probably mean looking at a different funding structure. And I'm curious about a funding structure similar to the BBC, which is a licensing fee, which doesn't go through the political process.
I would love for us to emulate the BBC in a robust way.
I know it's not perfect, and they're having their own issues, but
It's still leaps and bounds better than what we're dealing with. And one thing that frustrates me a bit, Ariana, is like here in the States, people are like, oh, you can't have the state involved with media because, you know, Orwell, totalitarianism. And you're like, look, like they've had the BBC for decades and it seems to irritate everyone equally. We've had PBS and NPR and no one's like, you know, accusing them of trying to create an authoritarian state. You know, it's like there's such like a deep reflexive knee-jerk reaction against the state having anything to do with media that I find not borne out by reality in other contexts, with the BBC being one prominent example. So who's reached out to you, wants to solve this problem, Ariana, wants to crack this nut? Like, because, you know, I'm someone who wants to try and fix this. But and I feel like right now you're one of the most prominent and visible proponents of media reform at this point.
I, you know, in the number of responses that I got when I posted my resignation statement, there were a number of different types of people. And so there were people who want to start their own new network of some sort, or podcast, or you know, nonprofit outlet. And I will say, like, I admire that and support all of that work. But personally, I think that there needs to be some network with critical mass. So when you have these piecemeal options popping up, it's all great work, but I feel like it gets lost. And, you know, the general public, it doesn't reach them necessarily like it should. So I feel like you need a place with critical mass where people know and are familiar with and can go to it. That's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I had a lot of people from the tech industry reach out, people that are you know, either with foundations or support foundation, you know, had do some work with philanthropy. They, I have been in touch with I've heard from a number of people, and I'm trying to, I don't know what is going to make most sense. I mean, it's kind of daunting. I'm doing this right now by myself in a lot of ways. So I don't know.
You are not alone, Ariana. We are with you. There are so many people who are with you. Just want to let you know
Thank
that.
Thank you. So I don't know if it's starting up a new organization or teaming up with something that's already there. I've just kind of been at this point talking to people. And one of that you brought up the fairness doctrine. That's one of the big questions I've had. Is that something that we should reconsider or something like it? You know, there are it had criticisms, you know, from both sides of the spectrum. You know, conservatives certainly maligned it, but there were on the liberal side, there were people who had criticisms of the fairness doctrine as well. So it's like, you know, how do you create a standard for news that you can, that's enforceable? And, you know, then you run into the problem, you know, if you have to give consideration to both sides of an issue, then you run into the whole, you know, false equivalency problem. And sometimes giving the other side that is not, it's not, really,
you mean
balanced.
The anti-climate change doesn't really deserve a hearing?
Oh my gosh, yes. And that was, I struggled with that in my years in public radio. We would do these discussions about climate change, and then you would have, you know, 100 scientists who were available and wanting to discuss climate change, and we were forced to find someone on the opposite side. And it was really hard to find someone who wasn't funded by the petroleum industry. But we had to have that voice, and it was incredibly frustrating.
No, that would be frustrating. I think at some point there should be like a 99% rule where if like 99% of scientists conclude something, then you don't have to have that outlier on. So I agree with you. There's a real consideration. Well, there are millions of Americans that want to join you as advocates for better media that actually makes us more informed and smarter and less inflamed. If someone wanted to lend you a hand right now, and it could be that there's nothing that they can do, but like, is there a way they can keep up with you, or say like, you know, I want to help support Ariana in her current activism?
I have my personal website, which is not a great website, but I post my activities there on the blog. I'm working on getting a new website to make that a little easier and a little more efficient. I'm on Twitter. I have not started any sort of an official organization. So if it's like, you know, I don't have a GoFundMe site or anything like that.
I love your instincts, Ariana, because I can sense that you are very much an accidental activist and an unwilling pundit, shall we say, in the sense, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there are a lot of folks who'd be trying to take this and milk it.
I'm a shy person by nature. So, you know, doing anything that is not, you know, behind the camera or behind the microphone, you know, I'm hesitant to do it, but I feel like it's so important that I do. You're right. I mean, I've been kind of pushed into this position. So
it is so important, and I can relate to a lot of it. People don't believe this about me, but I actually was happier to not necessarily be the front man of the band. But, so well, I get it.
We were all better off that you stepped out. So,
oh, thank you. That's very kind.
It's changing the discussion. And you know, it might be, I don't know how you feel about it. It might be incremental, but that's how it's, you know, that's how it starts.
Yeah. I'm in a hurry.
Okay. Let's not be patient. There's too much at stake.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, because of some of the things that you've outlined, so thoroughly and personally, we don't have limitless time. Like, time's not really on our side. And so you're going to be a force for bringing us together. I hope I am too. And please do consider me a friend and partner and resource, because we need you to succeed. We need you to find a place where you can just do what you do. You know, there has to be a home for producers who just want to produce good news that actually is what people need to hear, as opposed to what people want to hear to be pissed off at the other side in a moment, or they're going to get to avoid things that don't conform to their worldview. I mean, that's not great. And we are in information silos right now. But you're going to be a big part of the solution. I can sense it. And also, you have a fan in me and many others, because you did something so rare in modern life, which is you stood up for your principles. And you did it for a genuine way. Like, it really wasn't like some kind of self-elevation or anything like that. You were just like, look, here's who I am. Here's what I think. And now I can sense this too, but even your current approach. We're going to get to the bottom of this, Ariana, you and me.
I like it. I'm excited.